From KXJZ in Sacramento, I'm Jeffrey Callison. McClatchy is about to become one of the nation's biggest newspaper companies. What impact will this have on the Bee, the McClatchy Company, and Sacramento? You'll hear today on Insight. So today, two very different versions of Hamlet. One, a solo version, is touring schools in Nevada. The other, a new play inspired by Hamlet and set in the Middle East, opens soon in Sacramento. Actors and directors will explain what they're doing with Shakespeare's masterpiece. And a Sacramento woman who cares for the pets of homeless people when they can't. First, the news. From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, two versions of Hamlet shed new light on Shakespeare's masterpiece. One, a solo version, is touring schools in Nevada. The other, a new play inspired by Hamlet and set in the Middle East, opens soon in Sacramento. You'll meet directors and actors in both productions. Also today, a woman who spends her days caring for the pets of homeless people when they can't. First, the medium-sized newspaper company that owns the Sacramento Bee and the Modesto Bee is about to become a giant in the industry. Sacramento's McClatchy Company recently bid to buy the nation's number two newspaper company, Knight Ridder of San Jose. Knight Ridder's board announced today it had accepted McClatchy's $4.5 billion offer. McClatchy followed that up by announcing today that it would turn around and sell 12 of Knight Ridder's 32 papers, including the San Jose Mercury News and the Contra Costa Times. What impact will this big purchase by McClatchy have on its current papers and readers? Joining us by phone is Sacramento State Journalism Professor Mark Ludwig. He's a longtime journalist. His career includes work at Knight Ridder San Jose Mercury News and McClatchy's Sacramento Bee. Mark, welcome to Insight.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Well, there seems to be widespread relief in journalism circles that Knight Ridder decided to sell to McClatchy as opposed to a venture company. What do you think of the deal?
Well, I think, you know, sort of the sense of relief is that it's a journalism company that's acquiring another journalism company. Excuse me, both companies have reputations for doing quality journalism. I think there was some fear that companies that did not have that dedication to quality journalism would pick up the Knight Ridder properties and just sort of milk them for the cash that they could get out of them. So I think, you know, there's a sense of relief there.
When McClatchy expands as dramatically as it's about to, or appears to be about to, what impact will that have on the Sacramento Bee? Because the Sacramento Bee was for decades the flagship paper. It's now the number two paper. Once the Miami Herald is on board, it'll be the number three paper at McClatchy. Do you see any impact on the Sacramento Bee?
Oh, I don't think so. I think, you know, they've shown a commitment to doing some good journalism in Sacramento. And, of course, McClatchy is still going to be located in Sacramento, so it's still going to be a showcase publication, you know, for the company. I really don't foresee any changes in that realm.
Mm-hmm. What about to Sacramento itself? To have such an important newspaper company in the city. Do you see any impact on Sacramento?
Well, in terms of just saying, you know, that there probably will wind up being Sacramento's biggest employer when you include all the employees nationwide that would be working for McClatchy, I think that, you know, certainly gives it some cachet in the community. I think already it's one of the biggest employers in town. So, you know, but it certainly will raise the profile of the company in town.
Mm-hmm. Columbia University today released its annual report on the state of the news media, and for the newspaper industry in 2005, it said, quote, every indicator was on a steep downward path, end of quote. Do you think this is a bad time for a company to buy dozens of newspapers?
it's hard to say. You know, newspaper industry has been struggling because of the challenges from the internet and losing advertising to the internet and losing, you know, circulation has been declining. It's worth noting that McClatchy has had circulation increases continuously until about the past year, whereas the Knight Ridder papers were losing circulation. You know, both companies, I think, have been a little bit tighter in the way they spend money lately. When I worked at the Mercury News, we had a really big staff and covered the community well. And if you went to the Mercury News today, you know, it would be a shell of the way it was before. So what is the commitment to the companies in spending the money that needs to be spent to do quality journalism? That remains an open question. I think, you know, these days they've shown themselves to be not willing to spend as much as I think is required to do what needs to be done to serve the public.
Mm. As I said in the introduction, McClatchy's going to sell quite a few of the Knight Ridder papers. And the reason in almost every case is that the paper just is not a profitable, dominating newspaper in a growth market. And I think no one was surprised to see Philadelphia in that category. But it does seem a little bit more surprising that the San Jose Mercury News would be there. You worked at the Mercury News just a few years ago. Was the paper in decline then?
It wasn't in decline then, although you sort of, you know, got the inkling that they were going to be getting tighter and tighter with the amount of staff they were willing to keep on, the amount of money they were willing to spend on. You know, back in 2001, the publisher of the Mercury News resigned rather than make the sorts of cuts that the Knight Ridder Board of Directors wanted him to make. I think that staved off cuts for a while, but I think now, you know, they've made all the kinds of those cuts, I think, to save money and to help boost the bottom line, which Wall Street was demanding of them.
How do you think this is playing in San Jose, which is a city like Sacramento that lives in the shadow of San Francisco, and to be losing its perhaps its most prominent corporate headquarters, or one of the most prominent headquarters, to Sacramento, and to also see one of its papers not be wanted by that company in Sacramento, must be an unwelcome turn of events.
Well, I think, you know, a Knight Ridder is one of any number of companies that are based in Silicon Valley. I think that if people ask you what companies are based in Silicon Valley, Knight Ridder probably wouldn't come to the top of the list. You know, up until a few years ago, Knight Ridder was based in Miami. In terms of the newspaper, you know, I think that it remains to be seen what's going to happen with the Mercury. As one of the papers on the market, there's still a chance it'll get picked up by, you know, a publisher who doesn't have the commitment to the quality of journalism that Knight Ridder and that McClatchy had. So I think it's a dark day at San Jose just from that perspective.
Yeah. Well, you have experience in both McClatchy and Knight Ridder newsrooms. How would you describe the culture of each?
Well, I couch this by saying that my work in the B newsroom here in Sacramento has been only occasional, like every couple weeks and
yes,
a couple of months. You know, I think the culture was the same, and that you could sort of sense that, you know, people were professionals and dedicated to doing the best job that they could. You could also sort of feel the underlying sense of, you know, how much is this going to cost, and we have to look for ways to watch the budget and protect the bottom line and that sort of thing. So, you know, the financial pressures can't be ignored.
What do you think, where do you think a healthy and profitable and useful future is for newspapers? Because it's obviously a challenging time for them, notwithstanding the fact that McClatchy has made a huge investment in buying new newspapers.
Well, I think that if they sort of depend on their print publications to get them by down the road, that they're not going to survive. I think they need to become, you know, news organizations in the sense that they really need to look at ways to deliver their news online in ways that people will find compelling, in ways to, you know, generate revenue through sales or online subscriptions or what may they be. I think if they depend just on a print publication down the line, that they won't be in business for that long.
And finally, Mark, you teach journalism at Sacramento State. What kind of careers are your students looking for? Is there still the same proportion looking for jobs in newspapers, which traditionally were the most prestigious and certainly most numerous jobs in journalism?
A lot of them still are thinking about going into print publications. Being in the Capitol, we also have a number of students who like to go into, you know, government public affairs type work as well. I mean, we sort of, on the journalism faculty, are preaching the necessity of being able to work across media platforms, and it's just not good enough to be print, but you also have to be familiar with the way online news is produced, and you have to be familiar with the way broadcast news is produced.
Yeah. Mark Ludwig, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Mark Ludwig, Assistant Professor of Journalism at Sacramento State. A final note on this topic, the publisher of the Modesto Bee is getting a big promotion amid all this. Lynn Dickerson will move to headquarters for a vice president position, overseeing most of McClatchy's southern U.S. papers. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, two very different versions of Hamlet in our region. One, a solo version touring schools in Nevada. The other, a new version of the story set in the Middle East, opens soon in Sacramento. And later in the show, a Sacramento woman who spends her days helping to care for the animals of homeless people. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can hear today's show and recent archive programs on the web at capradio.org/insight. By the way, there's good news about the Insight Archive. Now all Insight shows stay online indefinitely. Our archive currently goes back to late November 2005. Eventually, it'll extend back to Insight's debut as a daily program in July 2004. Shakespeare's masterpiece Hamlet has been staged, revised, and reinterpreted for hundreds of years. Two regional productions continue that tradition. One is a solo version touring Nevada schools. The other is an acclaimed new version of the Hamlet story set in the Middle East, with its North American premiere coming soon in Sacramento. We'll get to the solo version a little later. First, the Al Hamlet Summit premiered to acclaim at the famous Edinburgh Fringe Festival in Scotland in 2002. The playwright, Suleiman Al-Bassam, is from Kuwait. The Al Hamlet Summit takes many of the characters and themes of Shakespeare's play and places them in an undefined Middle Eastern country on the brink of war. In our studio are the director of the Sacramento production and a member of the cast, director Anne Tracy and actor Blair Leatherwood. Welcome to Insight.
Hi.
Anne, tell us about the title first, The Al Hamlet Summit.
The Al Hamlet Summit. When Suleiman wrote this, he saw it as a summit meeting because there seems to be always summit meetings going on around Middle Eastern issues. And I think he saw it also as a way to be able to provoke, to criticize certain things going on in the Middle East politically that you would never be able to do outside of that classic Shakespearean structure.
And just in case people aren't clear what I'm saying, Al Hamlet is like Al Qaeda or something like that.
It's it does have that resonance, yeah. Doesn't it?
Yes. This play has never been on in North America, right?
No, it hasn't. It was premiered at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. It then went to some venues in southern England near London, and then it went to Cairo, where it was received. It received awards there. Then it was invited to the Tokyo Arts Festival and the Singapore Arts Festival. And this past summer, they were able to take the show to Elsinore Castle in Denmark. Can you imagine doing Hamlet at Elsinore Castle?
How wonderful. Now, Anne, you are, in addition to directing this production of the Al Hamlet Summit in Sacramento, you're the co-artistic director of the company that's bringing the Al Hamlet Summit to Sacramento, Beyond the Proscenium Productions. Where did you see the Al Hamlet Summit, since it's been all over the world except North America?
I have a tendency to read theater journals that are not mainstream. And it was in a theater journal either published by the University of San Diego or Yale that I read the script was in it, and I was blown away. I was at the time vacationing and helping my sister, and I'm reading the script thinking, I have to do this show. This show is so politically important and so poetically beautiful that I was able to find Suleiman and his theater company, which they're located in Kuwait and in London. They have two contacts in either places. And I just tracked him down and said, we have to be the theater company to do the show.
That's Anne Tracy of Beyond the Proscenium Productions, also with us, Blair Leatherwood, who's one of the cast of this upcoming production of the Al Hamlet Summit, Blair. Had you heard of the Al Hamlet Summit before Anne cast you in this production?
Well, actually, Anne told me about it. I went to see her in Gilligan's Island, the musical.
Shh, you weren't supposed to say that, Blair.
Really?
That was my last and final foray into musical theater.
And she told me about it, and it sounded like a very interesting project.
Yes.
And Hamlet has always been, you know, one of my interests. Matter of fact, the role of Claudius is, you know, one of those roles that I've always wanted to play.
Tell us about Claudius in the Al Hamlet Summit. How is he different, if he is different at all, from the Claudius in Hamlet?
He's not very different at all. Matter of fact, the structure of the play is almost identical to Shakespeare's Hamlet. There are a couple of additional, or there's one additional character, an arms dealer, mm-hmm. who sort of acts as a catalyst for all of this unrest. But in terms of the basic plot, the relationships between the characters, they are the same.
Remind us of who Claudius is.
Claudius is the current king of this country. He's actually Hamlet's uncle. He has assassinated his brother, Hamlet's father, and married Hamlet's mother.
And that was how he became king.
Right.
Okay. You have a monologue.
Mm-hmm.
You have a couple of monologues in the play, but you're going to do one of them for us right now, which is mm-hmm. Act 4, Scene 3.
Right.
Tell us what we need to know going into the monologue, and then do it for
okay.
us, please.
First of all, if you're familiar with the play Hamlet, this monologue serves exactly the same function as and is in the same place as in Shakespeare's Hamlet. There's the play within the play where Hamlet is showing Claudius that he knows what Claudius did, and this occurs directly after that, where Claudius realizes that, you know, somebody really knows what's going on, and it's somebody with the power to do something about it, should he decide to do that.
Mm. And I should note for listeners that we have made a slight edit to this monologue for FCC purposes.
Yes. Oh, and one other thing that should be known. The beginning of this, talking about money, there's a visual that you don't get on the radio.
Okay.
In terms of the money.
We'll use our imagination.
Okay. Oh, God. Petrodollars. Teach me the meaning of petrodollars. I am created in your image. I have no other God than you. I seek guidance from you, the all-seeing, all-knowing, master of worlds, prosperity, and order. This for the nation's new satellite TV station. This for God's satellite. This for the epic about my valiant life. This for God's film industry. This for surveillance networks across the capital. This for God's installation people. This for primary, secondary, and higher. This for God's curriculums. This for me. This for the leader of the opposition party. This for the Austrian torturer. This for the editor of the National Press. Or is he dead? This for the MD of crude futures. All of heaven's gifts down to the cracks of their arses, and I, the poor, sluttish Arab, foregoing billions to worship you. I am transparent. So transparent my flesh emerges like calf's milk. I beg you, Lord, give me the recognition I need and help me calculate what is good. Is it not charm? Is it not consummate charm to slouch on silk cushions and have and be had by all the flesh dollars can buy? I am a fine apprentice. Do I not learn well what you have taught me? This for you, O God. Help me, God, help me. Your angelic ministers defame me. They portray me as a murderer, a trafficker of toxins, a strangler of children. Why is this, God? I lie naked before you while they deafen you with abuse. Oh, let me not be disagreeable to you, God. I do not compete with you. How could these packets of human flesh compete with your infinity? I am your agent, nor am I an ill partner for your gluttony and endless filth. I do not try to be pure. I have learnt so much filth. I eat filth. I am an artist of filth. I make mounds of human bodies, sacrifices to your glory. I adore the stench of rotting peasants gassed with your technology. I am a descendant of the prophet, peace be unto him, and you are God. Your angelic ministers want to eliminate me, Throw me down like Lucifer from the lap of your mercy. But who brought me here, O God? Let us not forget. Who put me here? In front of your beneficence, I am a naked mortal full of awe. My ugliness is not offensive to you, surely it is not. My nose is not so hooked, is it? My eyes so diabolical as when you offered me your Washington virgins and CIA opium? Oh God, my ugliness does not offend you now, does it? Your plutonium, your loans, your democratic filth that drips from your ecstatic crowds, I want them all, oh God. I want your Vaseline smiles, and I want your pimp-ridden plutocracies. I want your world-shafting bank. I want it shafting me now. Oh, offer me the shafting hand of redemption. Oh, God, let us be dirty together, won't you? Without you, I cannot bear to be myself. Cannot bear it.
Thank you so much. That's Blair Leatherwood, actor who plays Claudius in the upcoming Sacramento production of The Al Hamlet Summit, a play written by the Kuwaiti playwright Suleiman Al-Bassam. Have you played Claudius, the Hamlet version?
Only in scene work. It's one of the Shakespeare's that I haven't gotten to.
Yes. The interesting thing about the language in Suleiman's play is that obviously it's not the language of Shakespeare. It's a different era, but there seems to be some connection still.
Mm-hmm.
There is a poeticism to the language, and a lot of it is taken from Middle Eastern and Arab poetry that has the same richness and beauty of Shakespeare's poetry. It's really amazing. I think that's one of the things that really hooked me when I first read the piece as well.
Mm. My guests are Blair Leatherwood, actor and director, and Tracy. And what language was the play first written in? Because Suleiman is Kuwaiti and he lives in Kuwait, but the play was premiered in Scotland.
He also was educated in both London and Edinburgh. I think he's also an Edinburgh U alum like yourself.
Yes.
And this version has come out of several other versions, the Kuwaiti Hamlet, the Arab League Hamlet, some of which were written in Arabic, and most of them were written in English. I had a chat with his sound and technical person just recently, and he said that in some of the classical Arab language that they used when they took it to Cairo, Suleiman had to have someone translate it for him because he did not speak that kind of classical Arab. So I think it's always been in two different languages.
Yes. Tell us a bit more about how the play was received in Cairo. Is the Al Hamlet Summit controversial in the Muslim and the Arab world?
Yeah, I think it's controversial in the Western world as well as in the Middle Eastern world. Suleiman has said that he's received all sorts of comments about how he's become a traitor by doing the show. And that show in Cairo, word got out that there were going to be some Western VIPs there, and they tried to get them in by the back door. And people out front thought it was being closed to just Westerners, that they wouldn't be able to get into it. So there was a riot that was started. And Suleiman had to ask the actors to do a second production of it for the crowd that was outside. And once they came into the theater and saw it, he says it was really interesting because they saw comedy in a lot of places where the Western audience did not.
Mm. Any concerns about the current time where obviously there's a lot of tension between the U.S. government and many in the Muslim world, and also with this whole huge controversy over the cartoons in the Danish newspapers?
Go ahead, Blair. I think that, to my mind, when I started working on it originally and doing the research that's required in order to really understand this, being not from an Arab country and only getting what I get in the news, that this really brought into sharper focus what the political problems are, which is really what drives a lot of what happens in the play and what's happening in the world. And I think that's what Suleiman's intent was to try to divorce, the religious aspect, the Islamic aspect, and the political aspect, so that you can see in a clearer way by working with a play that everybody in the West knows.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And by not messing around with the structure of the play, so that you can look at it and say, oh, there's a lot of political things that are going on that really have nothing to do with religion.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Suleiman is using this as a way to give Westerners another view in. Because we're getting this written from an Arab perspective. And what I like about the play, it does not take sides.
Mm-hmm. Why did he choose Hamlet? Why did he choose Shakespeare?
I think because it is, again, the kind of a thing where you can... There's lots... Let me backtrack here. In Shakespeare's time, there were lots of political... There's lots of political commentary within the plays that relates to the politics of the time. I think he used that as an angle, thinking, here's a framework that I can use to comment on political situations without being caught by the censors. Because there are still censors in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. In an interview, he said... that Shakespeare is, to the radical Arab theater maker, a walking toolkit of dissent.
Isn't that beautiful?
it's a wonderful sentence. Do you know what he's talking about?
I think what he means is that within the frame, there's a lot of space to be able to critique current political and social mores within the framework of a Shakespearean play. Especially if you're taking out some of the Shakespearean dialogue and rewriting and depositing modern dialogue in it as well, which our production does. There's a few lines from Hamlet. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of lines from other Shakespearean plays. It'll be interesting to see if people will pick up on that.
There's one from Dickens.
That's right. There is one from Dickens. But it's mostly political rhetoric, ordinary conversation, and then this beautiful poetry.
Mm-hmm. And if you look at the evolution of the piece from the Arab League Hamlet, mm-hmm. which is the first version that he did, it's almost all Shakespeare with the addition of the arms dealer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think probably what happened at that point was he said, you know, I can go further with this.
Mm-hmm.
I can update it. I can, you know, take these characters and modernize them and really bring it into the modern world.
And I think he's an up-and-coming playwright as well, because he has been, the Royal Shakespeare Company in London has asked him to do an adaptation of Richard III.
Well, that's big.
Yeah, it is. I can't wait to see that one.
Your production of the Al Hamlet Summit opens next week. And tell us when.
It opens
where.
March 24th and plays Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights at 8 p.m. at The Space. That's at 2509 R Street, the corner of 25th and R.
And there's a link to more information on our webpage, capradio.org/insight. Well, Anne Tracy and Blair Leatherwood, thank you both very much for coming in, and best wishes for the Al Hamlet Summit.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight on KXJZ. We're going to continue with our Hamlet theme by going to Torino now, where we're joined by Kenneth Duane Brown, who's an actor.
Hello.
And Jean Marie Simpson, director of the Nevada Shakespeare Company. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Yes.
And specifically, you have solo productions of Hamlet and Richard III touring schools in Nevada. Jean Marie, tell us why these solo productions of Hamlet and Richard III are doing the rounds in Nevada.
Well, we have our Shakespeare in American Communities project, and we had 6 actor versions of both of these plays in the fall in a 90-minute format. And for the schools in the spring tour, it has to be a 45-minute format. And so we, through the experience of the fall tour, realized that a solo version of each of the pieces would serve the structure better.
And where did you get these solo 45-minute long versions of extremely long, complicated plays?
Well, we've adapted them ourselves. We've been doing some version of each of these plays for 5 and 6 years. We first did Hamlet in 2000 with 6 actors, and then we premiered our 6 actor Richard in 2001. And we have, you know, as you do it and do it and do it and see it, you find that you can distill more and distill and distill and distill. And when you have one actor, you find, oh, okay, you know, and the work reveals itself, and you find out what the essence of it really is.
How does this one actor managed to communicate the play Hamlet. Do you distill it to one character, Hamlet, or is this actor, in this case, Kenneth Duane Brown, playing all the characters?
Yes, Kenny plays, well, we've cut many characters, of course, but he does play Hamlet, he plays Horatio, Ophelia, he plays Polonius and Claudius, and I'm sure I've left him, and Laertes.
Goodness. Kenny, how do you approach the challenge of doing something that is as big a challenge as Hamlet is in the first place, but while also doing it as a solo production and doing all these parts?
Well, a lot of research and a lot of help from the directors. It was Jean Marie and Cameron. They was helping me out on the project as well. And so, we basically, with a lot of research, basically.
Yeah. How do you distinguish between these characters who are so many different ages and backgrounds?
Well, different voices and postures and take on, different forms of the characters. So with that, a lot of character work goes into it as well.
Now, you're also doing the solo production of Richard III.
Yes.
How many characters in that one?
About 10. It's about 10 characters in that one.
So what's the total number? How many in Hamlet did you say?
Eight.
Goodness.
What,
that's eight
in Hamlet and then 10 in Richard.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's astonishing.
Yes.
So, Jean Marie, how's Kenny doing?
Well, Kenny is a great actor. I mean, you can hear, you can't see him, but you can hear him. And he's colloquially a Southern person. And yet when he gets on stage, here he's able to do all of this work on all of these characters and be so clear because he's truly a great actor. And he's a very young man. And so what he does is he goes into the schools wearing jeans and a t-shirt and tennis shoes and looks like one of the kids in many ways. And then he opens his mouth and he becomes Hamlet and takes it from there. And in Richard, he comes out as Richard. And Richard has very goofy, silly props, and it's done as a comic send-up of the play. But Hamlet is Hamlet. It has the tone of the production that Shakespeare wrote, and he does that with absolutely nothing but a chair.
Kenny,
and so
yes. Kenny.
Well,
you,
I was just going to say his acting is so good. All he has to do with Kenny, all he has to do is shift his thoughts, and you see the other character emerge. And he does have very specific postures in Hamlet for the different characters, and he's just a fantastic actor. He's very humble, and he's young, and he has a hard time talking about himself, but his work is phenomenal.
Wow. Kenny, what age are the school kids that you're acting for?
High school, it's from is it elementary?
All the way from K.
All the way from K up to 12, and some colleges maybe.
And how are they responding to these productions of Hamlet and Richard III? Because these are difficult plays to follow.
Mm-hmm. Oh, they love it. They love it. They absolutely love it. And afterwards they clap and they seem happy.
Well, they're very, very enthusiastic.
Yeah.
Again, because see, we are a very political company, and our mission is to subvert the dominant paradigm, and that's no secret. But with this play, we do it even more subversively by taking out the politics and simply bringing, an African-American actor into the inner cities with nothing except himself. And he stands there before these kids, performs this work, and they see possibilities they never imagined. Emerge. And Kenny does some rap as in the Richard III production. And when he's done, and in one of our fall productions, the kids asked him if he could freestyle. And I thought they meant swim, and I had no idea what they were talking about. And Kenny just jumped up and did 5 minutes of freestyle, and the roof just about came off the place. Yeah, so it really is about going in there, having kids look at a person who really doesn't look that different from themselves in terms of his age and his whole demeanor, and then he just transforms before their eyes in so many ways, and they walk out of there knowing there are possibilities for them that they did not know about.
Do you feel when you when you're going into the school, into the schools, that you're having to fight against preconceptions of what you're going to be, you know, giving them.
Oh yeah, they're always looking at me and judging me before I even open my mouth, and so it's sort of like it was a joke in the beginning, and by the end of it, they're taking me very seriously. So,
what do you mean when they look at you? Do you not fit their conception of a Shakespearean actor? Is that what you say?
No, not at all. I don't at all. You wouldn't never possibly imagine that I can do Shakespeare. So.
Well, yeah. Unless you have lived in the world.
Exactly. But, you know, a lot of people don't think when I tell them that I'm doing Shakespeare, they're like, "What? Wow, you know." And so it's weird for them and for me as well, but I love it.
Where has been the best response so far to these solo 45-minute versions of Hamlet and Richard III?
I can't answer that. They've been so well received everywhere. I mean, but we have done them. You know, it's been Northern Nevada, so they've been wonderfully received. But again, it is wonderful to watch people see Kenny walk in and you know, with his little suitcase of a few hand props for Richard and just a chair for Hamlet, and they look very skeptical. They just look like, what's going to happen here? And they are always simply amazed when the 45 minutes is up.
Jean Marie, why did you choose Hamlet and Richard III?
Well, what else is there than Hamlet? I mean, really, there's a reason that Hamlet is the most performed play on Earth. And at any given time, there's like 1,000 versions of it, I think is the number. But it is a play that actually blows a hole in the personal to where it transforms into the universal. It pretty much sets the standard for the micro speaking for the macro in terms of art. And when we, especially this version, when you have one person and in them with just a shift of their focus, with just a shift of their thoughts, they can go from being a little old man to being a young girl who's in love to being, you know, the usurper to... Just with a shift of the thought, you realize all of humanity exists in one person. And it's just so enormous and so transcendent that it just seems like an obvious thing to take to kids.
Yes. I believe that uncut Hamlet is more than 4 hours long, and you've cut it down to 45 minutes. Do you think you could keep cutting it further? And if so, how far?
Probably. I mean, you could probably get it down to 10 minutes with a simple suggestion. It would simply be a very simple arc of, you know,
start to become, you know, comic, perhaps.
It would. It would be comic. But what this does, theaters in our position of having a small budget, our budget for the year is only about $300,000, which is very low for a regional theater. And, what that has done over the 17 years of our existence is it's taught us to work within the possibility of that limitations provides you, the power of limitations. And Peter Brook talks about that, how when he did a version of Hamlet, he just had a Persian rug. And when you're on the rug, you're acting. And when you're not on the rug, you're not. And that's it. That's all they had to work with. And you learned that there's an enormity, there's an infinity that exists within the finite.
Any plans to take these productions to outside of schools?
Totally.
Yes.
They're so good. And they work so beautifully together. Actually, Hamlet works as a great first act. Then you take a break, and then Richard comes in as a wonderful second act. So we're actually going to... probably Kenny will tour in the schools in Nashville, where he's from. We have a relationship with the theater there. And we are planning to stage them in New York.
How exciting. So where are you next doing Hamlet and Richard III, Kenny? Is it today, tomorrow?
Yes, it's tomorrow at a high school,
yeah,
a middle school, I believe.
Okay.
So, he doesn't know where he is.
Yeah, but I know it's tomorrow.
Yeah.
He goes where the driver takes him.
Yes, and I perform.
Okay. Well, thank you both very much, Kenneth Duane Brown and Jean Marie Simpson. Nice talking with you both.
It's always a pleasure.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye. That's Jean Marie Simpson, director of the Nevada Shakespeare Company, and Kenneth Duane Brown. He's an actor playing Shakespeare's Hamlet and Richard III and other characters in solo productions that are touring schools in Nevada. Thanks to Nevada Public Radio Station KUNR for the use of their facility this afternoon during that interview. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, a Sacramento woman who volunteers at Loaves and Fishes caring for the pets of homeless people. We'll be right back. Listening to Insight from KXJZ, I'm Jeffrey Callison. Many homeless people have pets for protection and company, but what happens to the animal when the owner can't take care of his or her pet? One option in Sacramento is to leave the pet in the care of Annika Voss, a longtime volunteer at Loaves and Fishes, which is a service organization for the homeless. She's in our studio. Annika Voss, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Why do the pets of homeless people need your care? Where are they when you're looking after their dogs and cats?
Well, they bring them in the morning, and then they can do their business, take a shower, have a cup of coffee, or go have lunch and do whatever they need to do. Some need to, you know, to go to Genesis for mental care, a lot of them, of course. And then the dogs or the cats are left at my kennel. It's made from scratch, but it is in there. It's a kennel. We can have 44 or 45 dogs, several cats, and then they are put in cages. I wish I could do better, but that's what I have, cages, and I have a piece of carpet in it, and there is some water and food, and the owner is supposed to walk his dog for hopefully once, but twice. No, hopefully twice, but once definitely. Mm. And then they can stay there till 3 o'clock.
Do any of the animals stay overnight?
No, I'm not allowed to have them secretly sometimes.
Well, we won't tell anyone.
No.
So this is when they are attending to other business during the day. Are any of the animals abandoned?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course, and the owner might die because every week people die, dog owners, or they go to jail for vacancy, and that's normal because they're homeless, so vacant, you go.
So what do you do with the animals then?
Well, if the owner is gone or the owner has to give it up, then I find them homes. I put them in kennels. It costs $10 a day. Mm. And then, you know, the dogs are always fixed and have their shots, and we do the best we can to find them good homes. It's difficult.
If the dog isn't fixed when it arrives, do you arrange for that?
Oh, yeah, we pay for that. Yeah. I pay for it. It has to be, every dog in my kennel has to be spayed and neutered. That's my rule. There's a lot of arguing about that, but that's what I has to.
You said that that you can accommodate 44 dogs?
44, 45, yeah.
And some
and cats
as well.
Oh, yeah.
How often is your kennel full?
Well, in the beginning of the month, then somebody has perhaps a few hundred dollars in their pockets, and you can't live on a few hundred dollars, but you can drink on it. So then you don't have many animals. But for the rest, yeah, then most of the time you have at least 30 or 35.
Goodness, that's an awful lot of dogs to look after. Do you have much help?
No, I have one paid, one volunteer and who helps, and one paid person, a kennel, a cleaning person, and they stay in the kennel and make sure that the owner signs in with his name and everything, and that the animals are clean and taken care of.
And we should note that you're a volunteer.
I'm a volunteer.
And how long have you been doing it?
Volunteer for close to, I think, 22, 23 years.
My goodness. Why do you do it? must be a lot of work.
Yeah, it's a lot of work.
Yeah. Why do you do it?
Well, when it started, you know, if you see it, because the people when Loaves and Fishes started, they started also with hardly any money. So everything was dirt and dirt poor. And then at the end of that barrel of the dirt poor it are the dogs and the cats. And they, you know, nobody was there to help them. So you start it and then you have to finish it.
Yeah. You're originally from the Netherlands.
Yes.
Is that right? When did you come to the United States?
In 55. No, I married in 56. In 57.
Okay.
57.
And did you have a background in caring for animals, either as a job or as just as something you liked to do when you were in Holland or when you came here?
I always loved them and I always was worried and always was trying to, you know, I think that I was born already with that. Because as a small child, I was so busy praying for every horse that I met that I always was late for everything. Because, you know, in my time, there were still horse-drawn carriages.
Yeah.
And that was sad when there was an accident or they went wild. And, oh, that was horrible. I could never forget that. So I prayed.
When did you first start getting involved in helping to improve the lives of animals? Was it here at Loaves and Fishes?
Yeah, in Holland, you know, that it wasn't so obvious. The war, of course, yeah, it was very bad. But then there were no animals because they were either eaten or dead or, you know, or used for mining fields to run over by the Germans.
Did you have to eat domesticated animals yourself when you were during the war?
There was no food.
There were
not
to eat. Well, you said they'd been eaten.
Well,
but,
you know,
by
some people, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and there was no because I lived in a big city and we were the last group of people in that part of Holland that were liberated because the Americans were already fighting in Germany and the person that was overseeing us didn't want to surrender. Mm. So by that time, the people were dying in the street.
What's life like for the pet of a homeless person?
Hard. It's hard because, you know, they are exposed to so many more dangers and things because they're always in the street. For the homeless person, it is very hard. And then, of course, it is for the animal. There is many more dangers. And there's always something happening. There is always a car that will try to run you over. And, you know, it's bad. For an animal, they like to come to the kennel.
Yeah.
Sometimes they run away from the river and they are standing waiting in the morning to get in the cage. It's a little rest. It's quiet.
Mm. And what do the pets do for the homeless people? What do they offer to the homeless person that has the animal?
For a homeless person, and especially we have many people who have mentally. Not really all there. That is their family, their friend. It is everything. They talk to the dogs. That is the only person, the dog, that they trust. And I know many people who tell they tell all their troubles to their dog and the dog understands and listens, they say.
Mm.
And they use them for guards, you know, because it's dangerous to be homeless and on the river the street. It's very dangerous.
And most of these pets, for obvious reasons, I guess, are dogs, because dogs will
we
wander
have cats.
Around with you and
we have a man
you.
With a big snake, and we have this little, you know, possum or whatever
really?
They find, and it becomes a friend. Big rat, you know, whatever.
And a snake, you said, one homeless person had
a
snake.
Yeah, one has a big snake. Under all his clothing, he has to keep it warm. And then I can see his little head here sticking out from all these layers. And he's going with a snake.
And how long is your day, Annika? How long are you at Loaves and Fishes at the kennel?
I give my number out, you know, to my husband used to say it must be hanging in a public room in downtown.
Yes.
But because you have to have somebody you can call when you are desperate. So my number is out. They can call me. I go every day, wherever, you know, whenever, Saturday and Sunday also.
So you're kept very busy by this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very busy.
Well, Annika Voss, thank you so much for coming in today and telling us about what you do at Loaves and Fishes. It's obviously very much appreciated.
Thank you. And may I say something?
Go ahead.
Because what we really need is help with the vet bills.
Yes.
Because my vet bills run up to 7,000 a month.
My goodness. So obviously donations to Loaves and Fishes are much appreciated.
Yes.
Excellent. Well, we have a link.
Under the name of animals, Annika Voss.
Excellent. Well, people know how to find Loaves and Fishes. I think there'll be a link on our website. Annika Voss, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up on the KXJZ stations, some French lawmakers believe rap music helped spark the street riots around France 5 months ago. Now one French rapper is facing trial. That story in the day's news next on The World. Today's associate producers were Janet Mineri and Sarah Garut. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Our senior producer is Benjamin Jonas Keeling. Thank you for joining us. UC administrators underpaid or overpaid? It's a controversial issue. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Next time on Insight, experts from education and the Capitol say how they think top University of California officials should be compensated. Also, one Kings fan tells you why she pays sometimes hundreds of dollars for courtside action. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow at 2 on the KXJZ stations.